Membership in the American Chamber of Commerce, what's in it for you? Well, I can tell you from my 25-plus year membership that you will meet presidents, prime ministers, captains of commerce, CEOs of all descriptions, but basically you'll learn how business really operates in Australia. That's what's in it for you. Why don't you contact AmCham now and think about joining? They'll find a way to help you. AmCham.com.au.
This podcast is proudly supported by iLevel. iLevel's new innovative interactive video platform allows you to showcase your business knowledge. To learn more and view AmCham's interactive video, visit ilevelstudio.com.au/platform. Welcome to the business podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia, where you find out how business really works. AmCham podcasts are hosted by Dr. Duff Watkins. Duff is a director of Exec Search International, an author, and is also on the AmCham Council of Governors. AmCham, bringing business to you.
Hello and welcome to the podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia, where we explain how business really works. Leadership. When I say that word, what do you think of? Management, authority, ability, charisma, competence. Well, today we discuss the leadership paradigm, what it is and what it ain't. Today you'll learn why the majority of employees are not engaged at work. You'll hear how many leaders are continuing to fail in their roles and why. And you'll discover the knack for being a respected leader in your organization. My name is Duff Watkins. I'm the host of the AmCham Business Podcast. Today our guest is Jeremy Carter. Jeremy is the boss of Rapport Leadership International here in Australia. Rapport Leadership has offices in three countries, US, Canada, and Australia. They have over 250,000 graduates of their courses, and maybe you could be one. And their business is offering leadership programs to improve the personal effectiveness and to build high-performance teams of new leaders. Now, let me tell you about Jeremy. Jeremy started his career as a computer engineer. He worked his way up from an entry-level role to the Oceania Managing Director of the U.S. technology company, National Instruments. He did this by the age of 30. He also built a great team. He increased sales 62% in only 2 years. Oh, yeah, and he did that without hiring any additional staff. Now, the reason I mention this is because we're not talking theory here. We're talking practice. We're talking to somebody who's been there, done that. We're talking to somebody who, since he left that company, he's won multiple awards for both himself and his clients. And so let's welcome to the show, Jeremy. Welcome.
Good morning, Duff.
Jeremy, tell me a bit about your story. And also, I'm specifically interested in what was your first real leadership role?
Well, Duff, as Chief Enthusiasm Officer for Rapport Leadership.
I wasn't going to say that. I wasn't going to say CEO, Chief Enthusiasm Officer.
If that's not what a CEO is for, what are they for? And leadership comes absolutely from the top down, but more importantly, it also comes from the bottom up. And there's no such thing as a successful business. There's only ever a successful team of people. So you find that successful business leaders understand how to bring out energy and enthusiasm and discretionary effort in their team. And we'll probably touch on that a little bit later today about employee engagement and how bad it actually is out there. It's interesting that that word story pushes buttons for me, Duff. The reason for that is so many people use their story in a negative light to come up with all sorts of excuses for why they are where they're at. And I think one of the best things to recognize for any person, no matter where they're at in their life, they're at the perfect place to move forward and create whatever it is they want to create. And having had a 12-year corporate career, it was just the most fantastic opportunity that prepared me for to be able to go out and be in my own business. Mm-hmm. And the wonderful thing about working for somebody else is you earn while you learn. And for me, working at National Instruments was an opportunity to really understand the ins and outs of the corporate world and things that worked and things that didn't work. And it's interesting that very often events happen in our lives and we can frame these as either negatively or positively. And for me, an event happened that caused me to make a decision to leave the corporate world. And it could have had a negative spin on it, but in reality, it was an absolute blessing. that it was what's led me to my path that I'm on today, which is to be out there inspiring people to lead amazing lives and to be great leaders.
Can I pry and ask what that milestone was, or is that too personal?
Well, one of the things that happened was when our branch started growing very quickly, that we were allocated a new international sales manager. And this sales manager took care of a lot of Eastern Europe and emerging economies. And he had a particular style of leadership that just didn't gel with me. So it was, let's just say the whole office ran scared whenever he came to visit. And I remember one day I was sitting there getting on the receiving end of a lecture about what I needed to do to take the company to the next level. And the comment was, if your staff don't fear you, you'll never get the best out of them. To which my reply was, well, I think it would be better for you to hire someone who respects you, because I don't. And that was a interesting day, but for me it was a real pivot point, that day where I chose to leave the corporate world and venture out, and I'm grateful for all the opportunities I had and the fact that it's now got me out on my path, which is to make a difference and to build better leaders.
Mm.
Show me an organization with a turnover problem, I'll show you an organization with a leadership problem.
Mm.
People don't leave companies, they leave managers.
That's well documented. You mentioned discretionary effort, and the statistic I quote, based on the research that I've known, is that 40% of an employee's effort is discretionary. In other words, I come in, I come to work for you, I punch the clock, I work, 9 to 5, maybe 8, whatever the office hours are. That's 60%, Jeremy. The other 40%, you have to educe that from me. You have to somehow pull it out of me. You have to inspire it, because that's discretionary. I'll retain it until you give me a good reason to expend that effort. Does that sound about right to you?
The studies have shown that only 1 in 4 employees are what we call engaged, which is willing to go above and beyond and expend that discretionary effort.
1 in 4. That's a lousy 25%.
60% are what we call not engaged. So they'll show up at 8:30 and they'll walk out at 5:05.
They're mailing it in.
You've got their bodies and their heads, but you haven't got their hearts.
Yeah.
And 16% are not engaged. That is, they're simply showing up for the money, and they will fight change and cause dissent and sabotage the culture along the way. And the interesting question comes up with, well, what do we do with those not engaged people? And so often the answer is, well, we've got to get rid of them. But my question to you, if you have disengaged people in your organization, is, were they disengaged when they came in? What happened to them along the way? And one of the things that leaders have to be comfortable with is dealing with fear. You know, that feeling in the pit of your stomach when it starts churning, when you know you need to have a difficult conversation and you start to think, well, today would be a good day to tidy my desk instead, or I'll just put that off till tomorrow. You see, leaders recognize that as a trigger, as it's time to go to work. Let's step up, let's have this difficult conversation. And when you have those difficult conversations with disengaged staff members, then you can actually have the opportunity to turn them back into loyal and committed team members when you understand what the root of the issue is. Or you can give them the opportunity to go somewhere else where they can use their skills and their talents. You know, let's forget about exit interviews. Let's focus on retention interviews. Mm-hmm. Because once again, they're not leaving the company. They're leaving their manager and their colleagues. So mm-hmm. Something's gone wrong there along the way. Trust has been broken.
Okay, I'm a leader of an organization. I could be new, I could be an established one. I know that there is employee disengagement in my company, as there are and there is in so many companies. What do I do about it? I want to be a good leader. Every leader, I think, wants to be a good leader. Help me out.
That's a great question, Duff, because what happens so often is a leader wants to make their mark. They're put into a new role and they suddenly think that they've got all the answers. The interesting thing is, as a leader, it's about your team, it's not about you. And even if you have the answers, it's more about coming with the questions. It's about sitting down with your team to have that difficult conversation to say, number one, you know what, guys, I know a number of you wanted this role, but let's face it, I've been given this role, and I want to say right here and right now that we've been friends before this, But from here forward, our relationship needs to change in the workplace as your manager. What I'm asking for you is permission to give you honest feedback with the only intent of helping you be more successful. As your leader, I'm here to say, I don't have all the answers. And at times, I'm going to be asking questions of you because I only want to bring the best out of you. But what I want to give you is my commitment that I'll do whatever it takes to help make you successful. I will be as honest as I possibly can. And what I'm asking for you in return is honesty from your front. Because if you're not honest with me, then how can I possibly help you be successful? It's only through you being successful that I can be successful.
Okay, wait a second. I've been in the corporate world, Jeremy. Honesty is not always rewarded. I've had a little experience in that. Mm-hmm. So what do you think?
Well,
that's a big ask, asking people to be honest.
Absolutely it is. And that's why so many corporate organizations become toxic waste pits in terms of people who work there don't want to be there. Having done a lot of executive coaching over my time, I've worked with organizations where literally 40% of the brain space of the executives is taken up with how do I protect my turf, who's going to backstab me. And the challenge, if you want to build a great organization, it all starts with trust. If there's no trust, then you'll never have open and honest communication. Without open and honest communication, you never get collaboration. We don't get clear on roles and responsibilities, and we don't build alignment and work together. It's every man for himself. And as a leader, it's important to understand that you're the one role modeling the behavior. If you want your staff to be honest, then unless you be honest first, they're certainly not going to be. So it's about treading that line. Authenticity, I think, is the key currency of mm-hmm. leadership. Not pretending to be someone that you're not. Not pretending to have all the answers, but instead to set the vision, to protect the culture, to say, hey guys, we're going on an exciting journey. This is where we are today. This is where I want to take you. If as a leader you don't have vision, then I would say you're not a leader. And protecting the culture, because the culture is what builds a high-performance team. People want to be around other people like them. And the challenge so often is people settle for what is instead of focusing on what could be. And let's focus on creating great. Let's let go of good. Let's let go of average. And let's focus on what greatness actually means.
Okay, what if I'm a leader and I simply don't have that level of emotional intelligence that you're describing? I mean, I'd like to, but let's just, and I have just enough awareness to know that I don't have it, but what do I do? How do I lead then? It's again, it seems like a big ask for, and like you, I do a lot of leadership development work, and some people just lack the self-awareness. And they don't know that they lack it.
Absolutely. I believe people are doing the best they can with the resources that they have. And the challenge so often is that we don't see the world as it is. We see the world as we are. So by that I mean that we tend to project based upon our beliefs and values onto others what we think their beliefs and values should be. And if what we see doesn't match our value and belief system, very often we'll label it as wrong. Now, the interesting thing to understand that as a leader, it's not treat others as you want to be treated. It's treat others as they deserve to be treated and want to be treated. So it's about getting to know each one of your staff individually, about really what motivates them and what values they have. And it's about switching off your I know. And the challenge is what gets you to the top is a lot of hard work. Do, 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 mm-hmm. do. And the challenge is when you get to the top, you've done it for that many years, you're in this habit. I've got to do more. If I just work harder, if I lead by example, the rest of the team will follow. No, you don't. That's where you've got to switch off the do and instead focus on the be. And the be is all about relationships. It's all about raising your level of awareness, raising your emotional intelligence skills. And emotional intelligence at the end of the day is number one about self-awareness, your emotional state and being able to regulate that. Putting a bigger pause between cause and effect, action mm-hmm. and reaction. Mm-hmm. The other part is actually being aware of where people are at, reading between the lines. It's not what they say, it's how they say it, and very often it's what they don't say. So being able to understand in any given situation, what is it the outcome that I'm looking to have? And in this situation, who do I need to be and what do I need to do? If you only have one leadership style, you're doomed to failure in today's world.
You're so right in terms of what you're saying. In terms of neuroscience, if you pause between your initial reaction and what you say or write, it's why we don't hit reply all in emails because, you know, nothing good is going to happen from that as a rule. You have to pause, consider your response. Now, what happens when you pause is that big curvy bit of your brain takes over and dampers down the initial effect that comes from what's called the primitive brain, which is your emotional reaction. And that's what good leaders do.
And to add on to that,
yes, please do.
Another huge benefit is if you pause before you reply, people will actually perceive you as being more intelligent. And it's perfectly okay if someone, if my belief is if you're smart enough to ask the question, you're smart enough to know the answer. So you don't always have to give the answer. You can say, Duff, that's a great question. What do you think?
You mentioned before about leaders having the right answer. Now, this is somewhat of an obsession with some leaders to not just have the right answers, because nobody has all the right answers, but to appear to have all the right answers seems to be quite a favorite posture of some leaders, in my observation.
So I would absolutely disagree. It's about having the answers. It's simply about having the questions. And there was a Harvard study of thousands of professionals, and they looked at, well, what is it that above all else contributes to leadership success? And they looked at three criteria. And the first of those was IQ, intelligence, how good you are at problem solving. The second criteria was technical skill, how much do you know about the job? And the third criteria was emotional intelligence. And what they found with IQ was it was only responsible for 8 to 9% correlation with leadership success. And you'd say, well, surely technical skill is important. However, they found that only 8 to 9% correlation for technical skill is as well. What they found was that emotional intelligence, which is largely communication skills, accounted for more than double both of those combined. And what we see in the workplace time and again is that people get promoted either based upon the length of time they've been in a role. They might appear to be smart. They might know a lot. And they say, congratulations, you're promoted. Now, the big challenge is when you promote someone who's smart and knows a lot is they want to have all the answers. They want to be right all the time. So they tend to shut their team members down and they build very disengaged teams. And that's simply because they don't understand that whatever got you to this level of success in life is what's holding you back from going to that next level. We all like to do stuff that we're good at. And the challenge with leadership is you've got to let go of that stuff that you're good at and focus instead on what's that next level for me.
I know, I would like to be right all the time. It just doesn't happen all that often, Jeremy, is what I've noticed according to the feedback. What you're saying reminds me, I was doing a coaching program with a senior executive, he was the CEO, and he was complaining, and he said, Duff, I'm just doing the same things I've been doing for the last 20 years of my career. And I said, yes, Joe, but before you were the CFO, now you're the CEO, you're getting taxed in a different way. And in some ways, you're getting taxed on your vulnerable areas where you're least developed. And that's what you have to work on. I think that's what you're saying, Jeremy.
I think that what you need to be is comfortable being uncomfortable as a leader. It's about being outside your comfort zone and growing, because the whole organization is simply going to be a mirror of you. If your organization sucks, unfortunately, look in the mirror. If you want to fix it, the first place to start is actually fixing yourself. And the limits of your vision dictate the limits of your life. And the challenge for so many people in the later stages of their career is they've run out of vision. And everything in life that we achieve twice. If you don't see it up here between your temples, you're never going to see it out there in your world. And it's interesting that so many people just get to a level and they say, well, I've achieved enough. And the challenge when you walk the same ground over and over, Duff, it's called a rut, which is little more than a grave with the ends kicked out. And that's one of the reasons why depression is at record levels in Australia today.
You know, worldwide, yes.
Number one, people have a fantasy about the way the world should be and their reality is not matching up to that. Or number two, they don't have a vision beyond where they're at. There's no light at the end of the tunnel, or there's those people who always think it's an oncoming train. But it's about having that vision, because what happens is people play to win to get to the top. And by top, I mean that level at which they always aspired to, that level of their vision. And the challenge then is that they switch And instead of playing to win, they play not to lose. And we see it time and again in the corporate world where people, instead of focusing on what's next, let's make some big decisions, they want to play it safe and not make decisions because that's the safest thing. Because they're happy with where they're at, they're focused on keeping everyone else down. A leader's always focused on bringing people up to actually say, well, what's the next level above and beyond this?
Your comments about vision remind me of a line from the Old Testament, I believe, where there is no vision, the people perish. And you're saying it's up to the leader to provide the vision.
Absolutely.
For the people.
And the higher up the organization, the further your vision has to extend. As a CEO, you need to be looking 5 to 15 years out. But time and again, I see CEOs inside organizations, they're focused about what needs to happen this week and this month or this quarter. And that really needs to be pushed further down the tree because the CEO is about the vision, it's about the mission, and it's about protecting the culture and building a great organization that people want to be a part of.
Level with me now. I know you had a successful career as a manager, but you must have made some mistakes along the way. Let's talk about some of those mistakes. What did you learn?
Well, mindset is really important because success doesn't come the way you think. It comes from the way in which you think. And if you change your beliefs, you can change your world and your outcomes. And one of the things that I've learned along the way is just the power of pausing and taking time to really connect with people, to be 100% present in the moment. Because I've had employees before say things to me, and this is what I call the tap on the shoulder. And it's easy, if you're not actually listening very intently, you can miss those clues and you can lose a person from your organization. And that's a massive loss. When you have someone who was a truly committed member of your team and you look at what they take when they leave and the amount of time required to bring someone else back in. So I think my biggest thing is, as a leader, be focused more on the be rather than the do, and to really make sure you make the time to build great relationships with your team, because when you treat your team like family, and by family I don't mean taking liberties and yelling at them, by family I mean showing through your actions you've got their back. You know, the fastest way to get someone on your team is to get on their team. And it's not about what you say, it's 100% about what you do. So when you show through your actions that you're committed to their success, the trust is formed, and then guess what? They'll have your back correspondingly.
We pause here to thank Twitter Australia for the use of their offices and technical facilities. Very much appreciated. And we'll have a brief message from our sponsor.
AmCham offers strategic connections to a network of 29 chambers of commerce in the Asia-Pacific region. Learn more about how AmCham can open doors for your organization at amcham.com.au.
We were discussing off air the difference between management and leadership, and I was saying that in my view, managers or bureaucrats, and I mean that in a positive sense, not a pejorative way, that is to say their task is to implement things, make things happen through other people. And Well, what is the difference between management and leadership?
So managers are really important part of any organization, and managers are about creating efficiency. Because if as an organization you can't find a way to do things better than your competition, if you can't find some sort of edge, then you're not going to be here for the long term. Managers tend to be quite responsive more than proactive, and what it's about so often is it's looking at systems to create consistency. Now, the challenge very often is that as these systems grow, I call this bureausclerosis, a bit like hardening of the arteries, it becomes hardening of the organization. Mm-hmm. It becomes harder and harder for anything to happen without a massive trail of paperwork. Leadership, instead of saying, well, how do we do, is instead saying, well, where are we going? And what needs to change for us to get there. So it's forward looking rather than management tends to be a little bit more rearward looking. So both of them, it's the balance of them that's required to create a successful organization. The challenge so often is people just get trapped in management. So they're focusing on processes instead of focusing on people. Leadership's more about the people.
So how does a manager become a leader?
They do that by switching off their I know, and they do it by instead asking questions like what if, and where are we going, and what's my vision? What is it that I really want to create? And a really powerful exercise that any leader or manager within an organization can do is actually write a letter to themselves. Write a letter to themselves from their staff members, let's say 12, 18 or 24 months from now, thanking them for the outcomes that they've created and how they created it. Remember how I said anything in life we create twice?
Yeah.
So if you get clear about what sort of leader you want to be and commit to that, then through that, you know, that's a really powerful word, and I think a lot of people underestimate it, this commit. It's about making a decision to do whatever it takes to get to a destination. And one of the amazing things about the universe, it really is magic that once you make a commitment, it's amazing who shows up to help you along the way, the opportunities that you see that you wouldn't otherwise have seen. And so many people in their lives are more focused on playing it safe than having a big vision and going large. And I always go back to a quote by Helen Keller. She's such an inspiring lady, you know, being born deaf, blind.
But it didn't stop her from writing books and being quite an international celebrity.
Absolutely. And one of her quotes was, playing it safe is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. So I believe life is here to be lived out on the skinny branches, because that's where the ups and downs occur. And when we stay in our comfort zone, that's like a flat line. You ever seen a ECG in a hospital when it flatlines stuff? Do you know what that says about your life?
I don't want to see one either. Yes, it's at least not mine.
Well, let me tell you, the vast majority of people seem to be aspiring towards having that in their lives. And they don't realize that, well, it's the ups and downs that create the greatness of life. And when you have the mindset that you either win or you learn in life, then let's get out there and do a lot more learning.
So let me just make sure I understand. You say, you're recommending, write this letter to myself and project it 18 months, say, in advance,
mm-hmm.
where the letter is to me from me?
Yes. So this was one of the things to understand is you'll always do more for someone else than you will for yourself. So going back to my corporate career, at that time, when I was Oceania Managing Director, at that time, everyone would look at me and say, Jeremy, you're so successful. And at that time, I actually weighed 127 kilograms. Now, these days, I'm just under 100. At that time, I smoked a packet and a half of cigarettes a day and had done so for almost 15 years. At that time, I worked 100 hours a week. And I remember one day, I always had a belief that a team that plays together stays together. So we were out playing soccer with our team on a Wednesday afternoon in North Ryde, and I'd just run 40 metres down the field. And suddenly I had stabbing pains in my chest. There were bars and I couldn't breathe. And I remember sinking to the ground. And actually, first thought was, gee, maybe if I have a cigarette, these chest pains will go away.
You were a true smoker, weren't you?
Second thought
was, you were a committed smoker.
Is this as good as life gets?
Yeah.
And the interesting thing, you'd think after that I would have given up and got healthy right away. Well, no. It actually took the arrival of my son a month later,
mm-hmm.
where I got to look into his eyes for the first time. And there's no such thing as a time machine, but let me tell you, Duff, time certainly stops when you stare into the eyes of your firstborn.
Mm.
And I had to ask myself the question, if he turned out just like me, would I be happy with the man that he became? And that was a pretty big question to be asking myself. And a friend gave me an exercise. He said, Jeremy, I want you to sit down and write the letter. Well, I want you to write the speech that you want your firstborn son to give you, his father, on his 18th birthday about the lessons that you've given him. And let's just say there were a few tears involved. But that's the difference between successful people and unsuccessful people. Successful people will step up, put themselves out on the skinny branch and take a chance. I took a chance. I followed through. I did as I committed. And the universe moved as a response. So from there, I went on to doing my first City to Surf later that year. And these days, I run a marathon or an ultra marathon each year as my way to stay in shape.
or an ultramarathon. Yes, I heard that bit. So this transformation of you was both physical and psychological, and I think spiritual too. Everything happened at once. Or what I mean to say, the transformation was thorough and complete, and that has informed your insights about leadership.
I think if you want to get anyone else to change, first you need to change. And so often people are focused externally, thinking, looking at all the people around them and saying, well, they're the problem, instead of looking in the mirror and saying, well, if I lead by example, people will come to me and say, how did you do that? So congruency is such a massive part of leadership. If you're not on a journey as a leader, how do you expect anyone else to follow you?
How would you describe the traits or the characteristics of a leader?
For me, a leader is, number one, someone with vision. So they've got a picture of where they want to take a person, a place, or an organization.
Can I just jump in there? You're talking about a vision of 5, 10, 15 years. Now, most people in business now, I don't know many people who can think that far in advance, because technology changes so much, the world changes so much. So when you talk about vision, can you articulate or define that a bit more?
So it's just the picture of what success looks like. And for some people, yes, 5-10 years seems a little bit too far away. The thing is, sometimes we need to switch off our rational part, our rational mind, that part that says you can't do that, you'll never do that, and understand that psychologically we always overestimate what we can achieve in 12 months, mm-hmm. and we so underestimate what we can achieve in 7-10 years. And people get caught up in, you know, they set a goal once and they failed, and they think, well, it's just safer to not set any goals because then I can be confident in not failing. The thing with vision is it's designed to stretch you, and it's designed to really help you be clear on making decisions along the way. I mean, when we look back at when man first went from the Earth to the Moon over the course of 3.5 days, do you know what percentage of the time they were actually bang on target?
No.
So the answer is 3%. So success is all about constant course correction, that 97% of the time being clear about where you're headed. And I get the excuse from people so often, it's like, well, what if I change my mind halfway? And I say, well, that's perfectly okay. Let's get clear based upon where you're at now, the best way forward. And another example of this stuff is when I go up to the Hunter Valley, which is just up the freeway north of Sydney. And you come to a T intersection, and it gets me every time. And I come to this T intersection, and I look left, and I look right, and I look left and right, and it's like, oh, I'm just not sure.
Decision time.
The best thing is pick a direction and start driving. And the same thing goes, I see it time and again with motivation. People say, Jeremy, I'm just not motivated. I'm waiting for motivation. And they don't understand that motivation, the word, when you look at the etymology of it, shun means state of, motive means movement. Motivation is a state of movement. So if the fastest way to get motivated about exercise is to get off your ass and do something today. If you were to do it today and for the next 7 days, what could we say about your level of motivation? So motivation is all about taking consistent action. And the three questions a leader always asks themselves is, where am I going? Where am I up to? And what have I got to do? Where am I going? Where am I up to? What have I got to do? And so many people get trapped up instead of, well, whose fault is it? I really didn't want that anyway, or it really wasn't important, and they settle for good enough instead of really what could be.
As I understand it, when you make a decision, it actually is a neurological stress relief, because while you're pondering, thinking, worrying, ruminating, whatever it is you're doing, trying to decide, when you make that decision, when you take an action, it's a great, even if it proves to be wrong, it's okay, because you can always turn around and go the other direction or take that corrective action as you were just describing. You're reminding me actually something, Jeremy. I took a speed reading course and the instructor explained it like this. You're in a comfort zone. You're reading, say, 150 words a minute. That's been traditional for a long, long time. And he's trying to teach you to read, oh, say, 2,000 plus with 90% comprehension. And you do that through a lot of practice. And so you're taking a trip from the comfort zone to the discomfort zone, and you're treading a path, and that path has a name. It's called frustration, because it's really hard to practice that. But then when you arrive at that discomfort zone, guess what? It's now your new comfort zone. And that's how you learn, that's how you grow, and that's how you learn to read Aristotle at 2,000 words a minute with 90% comprehension.
Well, confusion, so often people label it as a bad state, but confusion is actually a fantastic state because it's a sign that you're making new connections in your brain. That's what learning is all about. And for many of us, it happened when we were much younger, maybe 7, 8, or 9, and the teacher asked a question, we put our hand up, and we got shot down in flames, and we made a decision at that point, well, it's better not to speak up, it's better not to be wrong, and we'd better not let anyone know if we're confused about where things are at. And the challenge is so many people have carried that into their adult lives as well. So I believe that growth comes from actively seeking confusion. Don't just listen to speakers who you agree with. Listen to speakers that you disagree with. The sign of an educated mind is one that can hold both sides of an argument at the same time. Yet what I see in today's world is, and I think it's a little bit sad, that debate has actually been shut down. Free speech isn't what it used to be, and it's very difficult in Australia to have a rational, fun discussion. I love discussions, and you know, some might call them arguments, but I think a heated debate, and to get to the end and say, well, you know what, we agree to disagree. But it seems like that art's been lost because it's all about win or lose and shut the other side down, or let's resort to personal attack. And inside an organisation, this is why it's so important that there's a level of trust. Because you want people as the leader to tell you if, and this is the biggest challenge of many leaders, is they're not getting honest feedback. Because it's very difficult for someone below you to tell you that you're not doing it right. Mm-hmm. The courage that that takes.
Yes, I'm just about to say that point. First of all, you say that confusion is a positive state. You can't believe how much that has enhanced my life just learning that from you today.
So hopefully we've confused a few listeners here today.
But I was just about to say, what you're describing takes a great deal of courage, physical courage, moral courage, intellectual courage, to say to the boss, hey, no, you're on the wrong path, you're going in the wrong direction. And I tell you, in my career, the most serious, the biggest regrets I have is that I did not tell a boss or a client, hey, don't do that. That's stupid. It's not going to work to your favor. It's wrong. Do not do that. And I have learned from that and much more forthright. But so how does a person get the courage to stand up to authority, to make those sort of bold statements?
I think it comes from, number one, personal integrity. And secondly, the leader actually not pretending to have all the answers and to be that little bit vulnerable and give their team permission to say, you know what, Duff, I don't have all the answers. If you see me heading down the wrong path, I'd really appreciate if you call me on it. And actually also then training the team on the appropriate way to do it, because active dissent in an open meeting isn't necessarily going to be good for the organisation. The right sort of debate or heated discussion in a decision-making meeting is good, but once the decision-making has concluded, what's important is that everyone supports that decision and pushes it out through the organisation.
Okay, let me press you on that. For example, I go to you and I say, you're the boss, Jeremy. I say, you're heading down the wrong path. I disagree. I think it's going to be a big problem. You should not do it. And you say, well, Duff, thanks very much for your insight. Let's hope your successor feels differently. Because, you know, that's the reality of a lot of corporate politics. Now, so going back to our earlier conversation, my courage has not been rewarded. Because I fail to recognize that you as a human being also have feelings and your same feelings as everybody else. You can get defensive, you can get hurt by criticism. So how does one handle that in the real world of corporate politics?
Thank you. That's a fantastic question. The best book I've ever read on the topic of this is Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
That's a classic.
And one of the things with politics is it's not necessarily what's right that gets through, but it's about understanding who are the decision makers, who are the influencers, and how do we achieve the outcome. And in a lot of corporate organisations, for you to get your idea to get up, you need to sell it to 5 to 7 people independently first before it ever then gets put out there in public. If you want to give feedback to a superior, there's a quote by a basketball coach that I think's fantastic, which is, average players want to be left alone, good players want to be coached, great players want to be told the truth. And you need to understand which one of those is your manager. And we can sometimes also do this with a question softener. Duff, I've got some feedback that I'd like to share with you. Would that be okay? Would it be okay if I shared a couple of thoughts on your latest change initiative with you? If you ask permission first, then it will tend to go a lot more smoothly. And the important thing is to be really calm and rational in your discussion. And sometimes good ideas take time, and it may be a case of planting seeds and watering them. And the challenge so often is people bottle it up and it becomes bigger and bigger, and then they just explode and it comes out in the wrong way. The relationship's fractured, trust is fractured, and that's where they say, well, Duff, have fun looking for that new job.
Yeah.
Because there was never the level of trust for the employee to be honest.
Yeah, there is a right way to provide feedback to superiors, or negative feedback or criticism or however you want to call it. And that takes as much thinking through.
You've got to plan those conversations carefully.
Yeah, yeah.
And perhaps it also makes sense to actually go and practice them with someone else playing the role of the boss if it's a critical conversation. And this is the other thing. If you want to be a professional in the field, you know, do golf professionals only play golf when they go out to play for money? No, they're practicing all the time before they get on the course. Mm-hmm. And the same thing goes for being a business professional. If you want to be a business professional, then where are you getting off the playing course and making sure you're going out there and developing your skills?
What about the role of authority? I got a guy, he's a new manager, and he's got manager on his card. And it has gone to his head. He starts telling people what to do. Can you guess how his staff feel about that? He's like, he's trying to impose his authority, like a dog cocking his leg, and is creating all sorts of problems. And yet, authority does exist, must exist in an organization, and it must be recognized. And some people have more authority than others. So what's the role of authority in leadership?
So French and Raven did a study in 1959 on the five sources of power. And the first two of those are legitimate power and coercive power. So legitimate is all about title or rank, which is so often what people think leadership is about, whereas, you know, leadership is simply an attitude. Coercive power is the carrot or the stick. And so often when people get put into management roles, they don't know any differently, so they're managing through either position, do it because I'm the boss, or coercive, or suffer the consequences. And this is what's called command and control style leadership, old style military leadership. And there's definitely a place for this in today's workplace. If there's a deadline, if stuff just needs to get done, there's no time necessarily to be nice. Stuff just needs to happen. But the challenge is, if you rely on this leadership style, is it completely disengages and demotivates the staff. We get what's called malicious obedience, where people will do what you've asked them to do, even when they know it's going to lead to a really poor outcome. Absolutely destroys trust. So there's three other sources of power above legitimate and coercive. And the first of these is referent, then there's informational, and then there's expert. So referent is about charisma and communication skill. And you're not there to be liked as a leader, but it definitely helps if people like you. So referent is your ability to influence people. Informational is about sharing the right information at the right time, and expert power is about having specific domain knowledge. So these three sources of power, when you bring them together, are called collaborative style leadership, where instead of coming with the answers and telling people what needs to be done, a collaborative leader will share some facts and ask them the question, what can we do? And even if we have the answers, if we get the team to come up with them, they're much more likely to take ownership of them, and that's where you create an engaged team. Your only function as a leader is to create a team that works just as well when you're not there as when you are there. So to create independence, not to create dependence.
So how do I get my disengaged team to being an engaged team?
Well, lucky I've got my magic wand here, Duff. I think the first thing comes to look in the mirror in terms of saying, well, who do I need to be? And what needs to happen. And the first thing you can do as a leader is to step up and take responsibility. To call a meeting in front of all your team and say, guys, I'd like to apologize. Things have gone off the rails. This team is not where I wanted it to be. And I'd like to say I'm disappointed and I apologize for the role that I've played in this. But what I want to talk about today is where we're going and to get a better understanding of you out of what we want to create together. And what's the environment that together we want to have as a team where we can come here, we can have fun, we can do a great job, we can add value, and we can make people's lives better. So if you take responsibility first, then guess what you're role modeling? guess what your team is quite likely to do in response. Instead, what normally happens in these sorts of meetings is the manager will walk in and say, guys, this is really disappointed. The performance has been absolute rubbish. I think, John, you need to do this. Pete, you need to do this. Stephen, that's completely unacceptable. And when you start assigning blame, then what happens is people get defensive and trust goes even lower. Mm. So let's stop focusing on what went wrong and let's start focusing on, well, where are we going? And how do we get people excited about getting there? There's two ways to move a person from A to B. One way is, you know, Duff, if you were my team and you were sitting next to me and I wanted to get you to the other side of the room, I could come in every day and yank on your jacket and drag you across the room bit by bit. And it would be effective. We would get there, but it'd be pretty frustrating both for you and for me. The other thing I could do is make it that destination on the other side of the room so fun, so exciting, you physically leap out of your chair and start running. And then you're coming back to me saying, Jeremy, I'm headed in the wrong direction. And it completely changes the relationship. You see, what we want to create is inspired people who are self-motivated to actually, and for you as the leader, it's about creating the vision and creating the excitement and to set the pace and to support the team in getting there.
There are a few things you've written I want to ask you about, some statements, okay? According to you, Jeremy, See, what you tolerate, you deserve. Can you elaborate?
Absolutely. This is just to understand that the standard you walk past in an organization is the standard you accept. And if you're prepared to tolerate people coming 5 minutes late to meetings, you're sending the message it's okay. It'll happen time and time again. And guess what? Whose fault is it? It's my own fault if I tolerate that. So it's about setting clear expectations. And I think the corollary that follows on after that is you can't manage people, you can only manage agreements. And so often people think management is about, well, I just need to manage this person and tell them what to do. And when you do that, once again, you create quite disengaged staff. What we want to do is have clear agreements about these are the expectations and these are the outputs, and to actually free them to have some creativity within their roles to be able to deliver on those. So once again, if there's a problem behavior showing up in the organization, you need to have a difficult conversation. The hardest conversations deliver the best results. That's one of my favorite sayings.
Tell me more about that. How do they deliver the best result?
It's always those conversations that you don't look forward to, that everything great in life, all of the success you want to enjoy, sits on the other side of your comfort zone. And the hardest conversations are merely the path that will get you there. As a leader, you're working not through processes, you're working through people. And it's through having those hard conversations in terms of if people aren't up to scratch, you need to have those conversations with them. It can also be the hard conversation to begin with to sit down and say, Duff, as your manager, I need to know from you, what do you expect from me? What is it I need to do to help support you in your role? How would I know if you're going on track? If you're going off track, what's the best way for me to bring you back on track? If I'm going to recognize or acknowledge you, what's the best way in which I can do that? So those sorts of conversations, they're not urgent, but they are important. And leaders are all about focusing on the important. The stuff it's easy to put off till tomorrow or next week, that's the magic that creates long-term results. So don't shy away from the hard conversations. Embrace them and welcome them, because you've got to recognize on the other side of that hard, difficult conversation is a much better outcome.
Jeremy, is there one takeaway message you'd like to leave with our listeners today?
I love the idea that it's not about what you say. It's not so much about what you do, but leadership is also about how you make people feel. And as a leader, when you make people feel like they're valued, like they're trusted, and like they're important and can make a difference, it's amazing the results that you'll see through them. So value and love the people around you and be surprised at the success that will bring.
And we'll finish on that note. You're listening to the Business Podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. Our guest today has been Jeremy Carter, Chief Enthusiasm Officer of Rapport Leadership International here in Australia. Hey, listener, I'm talking to you. Are you talking to me? I wish you would. We value your opinion. If you're listening to us through iTunes, you can easily hit the subscribe button, leave a review, make a comment, all of which are very appreciated, because we want to know what you want to know. What are the people, the topics, the issues that are of interest to you, just email us, podcast@amcham.com.au. In fact, you can listen to all the podcasts on the website, amcham.com.au. This is AmCham, bringing business to you. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the business podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. This podcast is proudly supported by Twitter Australia. Twitter connects everyone to what's happening in the world right now, from breaking news and entertainment to sports and other everyday topics. See what's happening in the world live as it unfolds. AmCham, bringing business to you. AmCham's annual trade mission program is your window into the USA. Join us for an unforgettable week visiting senior executives at iconic American companies from a range of sectors. Don't miss your chance to join one of our select delegations this year. Visit amcham.com.au.